Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, Viet Thanh Nguyen is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. He was awarded that honor in 2016 for his debut novel, The Sympathizer. He then received a MacArthur Fellowship in 2017. When he was 4 years old, Nguyen came to the United States from Vietnam with his family after the fall of Saigon. His experiences as a refugee, immigrant, and Asian American infuse his work. Viet Thanh Nguyen is a professor of English and American Studies and Ethnicity at the University of Southern California. He spoke at this Seattle Arts and Lectures event at Benaroya Hall on May 7th. Sonia Harris recorded his talk and his conversation with Hotel on the Corner of Bitter and Sweet author Jamie Ford. The opening poem was written and read by Weiwei Li. We're presenting our broadcast version here. To listen to the full event, which includes the conversation with Jamie Ford, go to kuow.org/speakersforum. Please note, this recording contains language of an adult nature, specifically racial slurs. Here, Sal's Ruth Dickey introduces the event.
The format for this evening will be remarks by Viet Thanh Nguyen, who will then be joined on stage by Jamie Ford for a lively conversation. Jamie Ford is the author of the beloved Hotel at the Corner of Bitter and Sweet, which spent 2 years on the New York Times bestseller list, and more recently of Love and Other Consolation Prizes. After an initial conversation, Jamie will include as many questions from all of you as possible, so if you have questions for Viet, please write them on question cards and pass them to an usher. If you're on social media this evening, our hashtag for tonight is Sal Nguyen. To officially open our evening, I'm proud to introduce a student from our Writers in the Schools program. This year, Writers in the Schools is working at 27 area schools in Seattle Children's Hospital to place local, professional, creative writers to inspire over 6,000 kids to write their own poems, stories, and memoirs. Tonight's reader, Weiwei Li, from Nathan Hale High School, where Viet visited this afternoon, will be reading her poem, Saudade. Please join me in welcoming Weiwei.
Saudade. I did not look back. I did not look back past duty-free, closing for the night, customs, security, check-in counters, to see where my father, I thought, would still be standing, the grumpy old bear watching his daughter walk away, before he went out into the black night, got in his black car, and drove home alone. I did not look back until the plane took off, saw the glow of my city, my homeland rushing away. And by then, it was too late. Since then, I am always half-turned, wherever I go. Into classrooms, turning corners. On metro buses or link trains. Walking to school, in the soft wash of sun and dew. Or headed home, with the chatter of a friend at my side. And cool evening falling. I keep looking back, but what I'm looking for isn't there, won't be there, cannot possibly be there. I look anyway. Sometimes, a foolish indulgence, when I crest a hill, I stretch toward the sky on the very tips of my toes, peering in the direction of the ocean. If I am tall enough, I think, perhaps I can see all the way home. I never do.
Beautiful. Such a gorgeous poem. Thank you, Weiwei. We'll have copies of her poem at the Sal information table, and you can also find it on our blog on the Sal website. And now, the moment we've all been eagerly awaiting. In Viet Thanh Nguyen's story, Black-Eyed Woman from the Refugees, the narrator speaks to us about the arrival of stories and of ghosts, saying, quote, "Stories are just things we fabricate. Nothing more. We search for them in a world beside our own, then leave them here to be found, garments shed by ghosts. This sleight of hand illuminates the heart of Nguyen's writing, the ideas that stories are just fabricated things, nothing more, yet also that stories are everything we search for, the only things that remain of us, the things we leave to be found, the things that give meaning, that stories and writing are the vehicle for making lives visible. His beautiful, nuanced work illuminates the history, identity, and politics of Vietnam, its past and its present, and the refugee experience from an incredible diversity of perspectives. He brings us the young, the old, men and women, straight and queer, living and dead. Viet Thanh Nguyen is the author of 5 books, including The Sympathizer, which won the Pulitzer Prize in 2016, the Carnegie Medal for Fiction, and a place on every best book list of 2015. His other works include the nonfiction Nothing Ever Dies, which was a finalist for the National Book Award, and the short story collection The Refugees. In his story, I'd Love You to Want Me, a wife loves her fading husband by reading. Quote, she would read out loud from the beginning. She would read with measured breath to the very end. She would read as if every letter counted, page by page and word by word. Across fiction and nonfiction and all his haunting work, Viet Thanh Nguyen gives us not just this portrait of love, of marriage, and of illness, but indeed of the whole complicated, fraught, and often violent world. The stories of forced erasures and his counteracting narratives affirming presence. We read them all, gratefully and hungrily, book by book, story by story, page by page, and word by word. Please join me in welcoming the brilliant creator and documenter of worlds, Viet Thanh Nguyen.
Thank you so much for that generous introduction, Ruth. And can we give it up one more time for Wei Wei Li, please? I thought she was absolutely incredible. I would have been totally petrified if I was her age on a stage like this. And I just want to extend a special thanks to Wei Wei's parents for not crushing her dreams of being a poet. You know, sometimes we look around, or I look around, and I think there's not enough Asian American writers out there. And yes, it's partly due to structural racism, but mostly it's due to Asian parents. Asian parents out there, you gotta do better. Now, obviously, I'm Asian. I'm also a refugee. And those two things are completely wrapped up in my life. And when I go around saying I'm a refugee today, sometimes I feel like maybe I shouldn't. You know, maybe I should say I was a refugee. Because if you look at me now, it seems clear that I've made this transition from refugee to bourgeoisie. But my first memories actually begin as a refugee. I have no memories of Vietnam, where I was born. But I do remember when we first came to the United States in 1975, fleeing from the end of the Vietnam War. My parents, my 10-year-old brother, and 4-year-old me. And we were settled in one of the 4 refugee camps that were set up to hold the 130,000 Vietnamese refugees who had fled the country. And we ended up in Fort Indian Town Gap, Pennsylvania. And in order to leave one of these camps, you had to have a sponsor. And one sponsor took my parents, one sponsor took my 10-year-old brother, and one sponsor took 4-year-old me. And now I'm the father of a 4-year-old, and I can imagine just how painful that must have been for my parents to have their child taken away from them. And I remember how painful it was for me as a child to be taken away. That's where my memories begin. And so I say that I'm a refugee because in some part of my mind, that's where I began. That's how I began telling stories to myself. And of course, it seems urgent today for those of us who are refugees to claim that we are refugees at a moment when this country and many other countries are so deeply set against taking more refugees into this country and other countries as well. I can't, part of me though, when I think about being a refugee, thinks it wasn't all bad because it gave me the necessary emotional damage necessary to become a writer. And for me, the experience of being a refugee is also wrapped up completely with war. In most cases, refugees are fleeing from war, and that certainly was the case in my parents' experience. And so the first thing I want to read to you tonight is from this novel, The Sympathizer, which is a war novel, but it's also a refugee novel. And for those of you who haven't read The Sympathizer, first of all, shame on you. second of all, it's about a communist spy in the South Vietnamese army in 1975, as Saigon is about to fall or be liberated, depending on your point of view. And his mission is to flee with the remnants of that army to the United States, where he's going to spy on their efforts to take their country back. So he has to become a refugee. And in this first scene, he is in the much more glamorous refugee camp of Camp Pendleton in Southern California, and he's writing to his aunt in Paris, describing what life is like in a refugee camp. If allowed to stay together, I told my aunt, we could have incorporated ourselves into a respectably sized, self-sufficient colony, a pimple on the buttocks of the American body politic, sufficiently collective to elect our own representative to the Congress and have a voice in our America, a little Saigon as delightful, delirious, and dysfunctional as the original, which was exactly why we were not allowed to stay together, but were instead dispersed by bureaucratic fiat. Wherever we found ourselves, we found each other. We did our best to conjure up the culinary staples of our culture, but since we were dependent on Chinese markets, our food had an unacceptably Chinese tinge, another blow in the gauntlet of our humiliation that left us with a sweet and sour taste of unreliable memories. Just correct enough to evoke the past, just wrong enough to remind us that the past was forever gone, missing, along with the proper variety, subtlety, and complexity of our universal solvent, fish sauce. Oh, fish sauce. How we missed it. How nothing tasted right without it. This pungent, liquid condiment of the darkest sepia hue was much denigrated by foreigners for its supposedly horrendous reek, lending new meaning to the phrase, there's something fishy around here. For we were the fishy ones. We used fish sauce the way Transylvanian villagers wore cloves of garlic to ward off vampires. In our case, to establish a perimeter with those Westerners who could never understand that what was truly fishy was the nauseating stench of cheese. It's not a joke, it's really disgusting. What was fermented fish compared to curdled milk? But out of deference to our host, we kept our feelings to ourselves, sitting close to one another on prickly sofas and scratchy carpets, our knees touching under crowded kitchen tables, chewing on dried squid and the cud of remembrance until our jaws ached, trading stories heard second and third hand about our scattered countrymen. This was the way we learned of the Klan turned into slave labor by a farmer in Modesto, and the naive girl who flew to Spokane to marry her GI sweetheart and was sold to a brothel, and the widower with 9 children who went out into a Minnesotan winter and lay down in the snow on his back with mouth open until he was buried and frozen, and the regretful refugees on Guam who petitioned to go back to Vietnam, never to be heard from again, and the devout Buddhist who spanked his young son and was arrested for child abuse in Houston, and the husband who slapped his wife and was jailed for domestic violence in Raleigh, and the men who had escaped but left wives behind in the chaos, and the women who had escaped but left husbands behind, and the children who had escaped without parents and grandparents, and the families missing 1, 2, 3 or more children. Sifting through the dirt, we panned for gold, the story of the baby orphan adopted by a Kansas billionaire, or the mechanic who bought a lottery ticket in Arlington and became a multimillionaire, or the girl elected president of her high school class in Baton Rouge, or the boy accepted by the University of Washington from Fond du Lac. I'm just kidding. It's actually Harvard in the original. I have to say this because I was rejected from the University of Washington when I applied there. Or the movie star you love so much, Dear Aunt, who circled the world from airport to airport, no country letting her in after the fall of Saigon, none of her American movie star friends returning her desperate phone calls until, with her last dime, she snagged Tippi Hedren, who flew her to Hollywood. So it was that we soaped ourselves in sadness and we rinsed ourselves with hope, and for all that we believed, almost every rumor we heard, almost all of us refused to believe that our nation was dead. So the Tippi Hedren story is actually a true story. And the movie star was Giep Chinh, the most famous South Vietnamese movie star of the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. And Tippi Hedren came to Camp Pendleton and took such pity on the Vietnamese refugees that she encountered that she had her personal manicurist come and train some of these women in the arts of manicuring, which is how 40 years later, we Vietnamese people have come to take over 51% of the nail salon industry in this country. Either a pro-refugee story or an anti-refugee story, depending on your point of view. Personally, I think it's a pro-refugee story. And when the sympathizer came out, something happened that I knew was going to happen, which is that many of the reviews called this book an immigrant book and called me an immigrant writer. And I had to go to New York Times and write that that's not true. I'm a refugee. And this is a refugee novel, and it's a war novel. And every time I go give a talk, I have to keep asserting the same thing. Because the idea of the immigrant is very strong in American society. I went to give a talk today at Nathan Hale High School, and I was told that some of the students who were going to meet me were refugees. So I asked the whole room full of students, how many of you are refugees? Not a single person raised their hand. I said, how many of you are immigrants? And they started to raise their hand. In other words, we live in a society in which, even now, at a moment of rising xenophobia and anti-immigrant feeling, which is not new in American society, it's been with us from the very beginning. Even in this moment, the people who don't like immigrants still like the idea of immigrants. They like the idea of immigrants wanting to come to this country because it proves that we're awesome, the land of the American dream. Refugees are a different case altogether. Refugees are the unwanted where they come from, the unwanted where they go to, and I think that's one of the reasons why some of those students who are refugees today didn't want to raise their hands and be identified as a refugee. And it's exactly for that reason that I want to raise my hand and say, I'm a refugee. It's also important because there are some refugees out there who not only don't want to be called refugees anymore, but don't want to let in any more refugees. I'm thinking about some of my Vietnamese brothers and sisters out there, these former refugees who are saying, we were the good refugees. These new refugees from places like Syria, those are the bad refugees. Don't let them in. Well, I grew up in a Vietnamese refugee community in the 1970s and 1980s, and I can tell you, there were a lot of bad Vietnamese refugees. Welfare fraud, insurance scams, cash under the table economies. I know all about it. We invented the home invasion. The phenomenon of Vietnamese gangsters robbing Vietnamese homes was so prevalent that the San Jose Police Department had to invent that term just for us. But we've forgotten all about that. Instead, we remember people like my older brother, who, after being taken away from the family for 2 years by a sponsor, went on to Harvard. And then, just to rub it in, went to Stanford too. Which is what you're supposed to do when you're Asian. Anything less is like the Asian F, otherwise known as the B+. But we choose to remember people like my brother, people like me, people like all these so-called good refugees, and we forget that in 1975, actually, the majority of Americans did not want to accept Vietnamese refugees and Cambodian refugees and Laotian refugees. And I had a very personal experience with that. In 1978, my parents decided to move from Harrisburg to San Jose, California. Thank God. And when they were there, they opened perhaps the second Vietnamese grocery store in that city, downtown. And I remember walking down the street in downtown San Jose, near my parents' store, and seeing a sign in another window that said, "Another American driven out of business by the Vietnamese. And at 10 or 11 years of age, I really didn't know what to make of this sign, except to feel that obviously it was directed against people like me and my parents. And I thought, does the person who wrote this sign know that my parents work 12 to 14 hour days every day of the year in this grocery store, except Christmas, Easter, and New Year's? Does the person who wrote this sign know that my parents were shot in their store on Christmas Eve? Does this person know what my parents have been through to become the people that they are and to get to this country? And of course, that person didn't know that. We were not human beings to this person. We were just Vietnamese, just refugees, just a threat. And then later, I would go to this very elite high school in San Jose that was mostly a white high school, except there were a handful of us who were of Asian descent. We knew we were different. And every day at lunch, we would gather in a corner of the campus, and we would call ourselves the Asian Invasion. We didn't even have a term to describe ourselves except this racist term, which evoked a whole history of Asians threatening this country. And of course, I knew by that time that I had come from Vietnam and that I'd been brought here by something called the Vietnam War. And I would spend many decades of my life trying to understand the history of this war, try to make sense out of it, try to understand how it had shaped this country, shaped Vietnamese refugees, shaped Vietnam, and shaped me as well. So I want to share a bit from my book, Nothing Ever Dies, Vietnam and the Memory of War, where I talk about this. As a gook, in the eyes of some, I can testify that being remembered as the other is a dismembering experience, what we can call a disremembering. Disremembering is not simply the failure to remember. Disremembering is the unethical and paradoxical mode of forgetting at the same time as remembering, or from the perspective of the other who is disremembered, of being simultaneously seen and not seen. Disremembering allows someone to see right through the other, an experience rendered so memorably by Ralph Ellison in the opening pages of Invisible Man. His narrator, the titular hero, runs into a white man who refuses to see him, and enraged, strikes back to force the white man to see him. Even beaten, however, the white man refuses to see him the way he wishes to be seen. That is because the other's use of physical force may make the other visible, but only to turn him into a target. The other must deploy the psychic forces of remembering, imagining, and narrating if the other wishes to transform ways of seeing. Not satisfied with being disremembered, we who are others find that it is up to us to remember ourselves. Having carried ourselves over or been brought over from the other side, we gooks, we goo-goos, we slopes, we dinks, we zipperheads, we slant eyes, we yellow ones, we brown ones, we Japs, we chinks, we ragheads, we sand niggers, we orientals, we who cannot be distinguished between ourselves because we all look alike. We know that the condition of our being and our self-representation is that we are both ourselves and others. We are never without identity and never without ideology, whether we like it or not, whether we acknowledge it or not. Those people who believe themselves to be beyond identity and ideology will, sooner or later, charge us with identity and ideology if we dare to commit that most unnatural act of speaking up and out. So I've been speaking up and out. Thank you. Thank you. I've been speaking up and out a lot about the Vietnam War. And part of my attempts to understand the Vietnam War are to understand that it is part of a much longer and larger history of war for both Vietnam and the United States. So I'm just going to talk about the United States because I'm here tonight. For me, when I was growing up in that Vietnamese refugee community, It was clear that even though the war was declared over in 1975, it was not actually over. The war continued for all of these Vietnamese refugees who felt that they had lost everything, their relatives, their properties, their careers, their identities, their country. And I grew up hearing all kinds of Vietnamese stories told by relatives and told by the people of this community that were steeped in rage and anger and bitterness and loss and melancholy. But when they spoke in English to the rest of America, what they would say is, "Thank you, America, for saving us." Even though in private, some of them would say, "America betrayed us." The war wasn't over just because it was declared to be over. And in traveling around this country and talking to many American audiences, encountering many American veterans, and also Americans who were just here watching the war from afar or protesting, it's clear that for many of these Americans, the war was the defining experience of their generation. It's not over for many of them either. And so one of the things I say in the book, Nothing Ever Dies, is that all wars are fought twice. The first time on the battlefield, the second time in memory. And it's clear in looking at our history as Americans, we see that Charlottesville happened. The Civil War is not over for Americans 150 or more years after the fact. Why would we expect people who survived the Vietnam War 40 years after the fact to have put the war behind them? And in this Vietnamese refugee community, what was also obvious to me was that many of these people who had been affected by the war were not just soldiers or men, but were women and children and civilians. And I think the United States is not unique in the world that when we hear the word war as Americans, we think of men and soldiers and guns and battles and tanks, and we don't think about civilians and women and refugees, even though all wars kill civilians and all wars produce refugees. And the Vietnam War was not unique in the history of the 20th century. It was actually completely typical for killing more civilians than it did soldiers. And I teach a class on the Vietnam War, and my students go out there and they interview survivors of this war. And what they discover is that when they interview American veterans, they find out that some of these American veterans have been through terrible experiences of combat, and that a lot of these American veterans have not. They were serving on a ship, or they were guarding a base, they never fired a shot, they were never shot at. But they interview Southeast Asian refugees who have made it to the United States, and they discover that every single one of these refugees has endured a traumatic, terrible experience to get to this country. That, for me, is also a war story, and one that we're reluctant to acknowledge. It's easier for us to imagine war as involving soldiers, much more difficult to imagine war as involving civilians. My teacher, Maxine Hong Kingston, also wrote about the Vietnam War in her book, Chinamen, with a passage that I will never forget. She had a brother who went to the Vietnam War, sat on a Navy ship, never got shot at. And Kingston writes about what it's like to be in the United States at home during this time. And she says, when you open the door of your refrigerator, you're supporting the war effort. Because the companies that make the plastic that wrap your Wonder Bread and the companies that make the coolant that goes into the refrigerator and the companies that make the refrigerator are all part of the same system that makes Agent Orange and manufactures bombs. That's a war story too. It's a boring war story. And boring war stories are actually, I think, much more terrifying than war stories about battle, for civilians anyway, because they implicate all of us in what is happening in a military industrial complex. And growing up in San Jose in the 1970s and 1980s, I was surrounded by the sense that this war hadn't ended for me either, because I kept seeing all these movies about the Vietnam War that America was making at this time. And around 1980, 1981, my parents brought home this new invention called the VCR. And after I watched Star Wars for a dozen times, I found Apocalypse Now. An example of what happens when parents bring home cutting-edge technology and leave their children at home alone with it. So I watched Apocalypse Now, and I was an American. I loved American war movies. I grew up watching American war movies, John Wayne and all of that. And I identified with American soldiers. And in watching Apocalypse Now, I identified with the American soldiers up until the point they killed Vietnamese civilians. And at that moment, I felt myself split in two. Was I the American doing the killing, or was I the Vietnamese being killed? And I don't think I fully realized the impact this movie had on me until about a decade later when I went to college and I recounted this story to a college classroom, and I found myself shaking with rage and anger and disgust, and realized that I had been traumatized. Not traumatized as badly as refugees or soldiers, but traumatized nevertheless. And it convinced me that this was evidence that stories were powerful. Another American driven out of business by fill in the blank is a powerful story. Movies like Apocalypse Now are powerful stories. And I thought, I can try to be a writer, and I can try to change these stories in my own way. Which is why when I wrote The Sympathizer, I thought, now's my time to take revenge on Apocalypse Now and Hollywood. So my narrator, after he leaves that refugee camp, has to get a job. And one of the jobs that he gets is to become the authenticity consultant on the making of a movie that looks suspiciously like Apocalypse Now, but if Francis Ford Coppola's lawyers were to ask, is not about Apocalypse Now. And in fact, it isn't. Like I said, I watched almost every movie that Hollywood made about the Vietnam War, which is an exercise I recommend to nobody. And many of them make their appearance in this fictional movie called The Hamlet. So the narrator, the protagonist, my spy, has read the Hamlet screenplay and sent his notes to the famous director who is known only as the auteur. And here in this scene, he and the auteur are going to discuss the Hamlet. And it's about American Green Berets who go to the Central Highlands of Vietnam, where their task is to train the local ethnic minorities, whom they call Montagnards, to defend themselves against communism. My meeting with the auteur had gone on for a while longer, mostly in a more subdued fashion, with me pointing out that the lack of speaking parts for Vietnamese people in a movie set in Vietnam might be interpreted as cultural insensitivity. Do you not think it would be a little more believable, I said, a little more realistic, a little more authentic, for a movie set in a certain country, for the people in that country to have something to say, instead of having your screenplay direct, as it does now, cut to villagers speaking in their own language? Do you think it might not be decent to let them actually say something, instead of simply acknowledging that there's some kind of sound coming from their mouths? Could you not even just have them speak a heavily accented English? You know what I mean, Ching Chong English? Just to pretend that they are speaking in an Asian language that somehow American audiences can strangely understand? The auteur grimaced and said, very interesting. Great stuff. Loved it. But I had a question. What was it? Oh, yes. How many movies have you made? None. Isn't that right? None. Zero. Zilch. Nada. Nothing. And however you say it in your language. So thank you for telling me how to do my job. Now get the hell out of my house and come back after you've made a movie or two. Maybe then I'll listen to one or two of your cheap ideas. By the way, since the book came out, I've actually met quite a few Hollywood people, and none of them dispute this characterization. I confess to being angry with the auteur, but was I wrong in being angry? This was especially the case when he acknowledged he did not even know that Montagnard was simply a French catch-all term for the dozens of Highland minorities. What if, I said to him, I wrote a screenplay about the American West and simply called all the natives Indians. You'd want to know whether the cavalry was fighting the Navajo or Apache or Comanche, right? Likewise, I would want to know, when you say these people are Montagnards, whether we speak of the Bru or the Nung or the Te. Let me tell you a secret, the auteur said. You ready? Here it is. No one gives a shit. He was amused by my wordlessness. To see me without words is like seeing one of those Egyptian felines without hair, a rare, not necessarily desirable occasion. How could I be so dense? How could I be so deluded? I naively believed that I could divert the Hollywood organism from its goal, the simultaneous lobotomization and pickpocketing of the world's audiences. Hollywood did not just make horror movie monsters, it was its own horror movie monster smashing me under its foot. I had failed, and the auteur would make the Hamlet as he intended, with my countrymen serving merely as raw material for an epic about white men saving good yellow people from bad yellow people. I pitied the French for their naivete in believing they had to visit a country in order to exploit it. Hollywood was much more efficient, imagining the countries it wanted to exploit. I was maddened by my helplessness before the auteur's imagination and machinations. His arrogance marked something new in the world, for this was the first war where the losers would write history instead of the victors, courtesy of the most efficient propaganda machine ever created, with all due respect to Joseph Goebbels and the Nazis, who never achieved global domination. Hollywood's high priest understood innately the observation of Milton's Satan, that it was better to rule in hell than serve in heaven, better to be villain, loser, or anti-hero than virtuous extra, so long as one commanded the bright lights of center stage. In this forthcoming Hollywood tremblay, all the Vietnamese of any side would come out poorly, herded into the roles of the poor, the innocent, the evil, or the corrupt. Our fate was not to be merely mute. We were to be struck dumb. Well, when the novel came out, something else happened that I knew was going to happen. Thank you. Something else happened that I knew was going to happen, which is that in the first major review of the book, which was very positive, and I was very thankful for that, but in the second or third line of the reviewer said, "Viet is the voice for the voiceless." I was like, no. Have you ever met any Vietnamese people? Been to a Vietnamese household, a Vietnamese restaurant, Vietnam itself? We're really, really loud. The problem is not that we're voiceless, it's that we're not heard. And that's a condition that we share with many other minorities and marginalized communities in this country or any other country. And so certainly as a writer, I believe that we need more voices like Wei Wei. We need more voices. We can never have a shortage of voices. But I'm not under the delusion that somehow being called a voice for the voiceless is a compliment. What it really means is that people would rather hear one voice speak for an entire community because it makes it easier for them. They don't want to listen to the chorus of voices that comes from any community, or in the case of the Vietnamese community, the cacophony of voices of that community. It's easier simply to have one person, the representative. And my interest is not in being a voice for the voiceless. We see today the dangers of people who take too seriously that role for themselves. What I'm interested in is working for justice so that we will have a time when there won't be voiceless people and voiceless communities. That's why I think of myself as a writer, but always as a writer whose work has been made possible by the social and political movements and struggles that have gone before to create the conditions for someone like me to write. If there hadn't been an Asian American movement, I would still be the Asian invasion. I would be the yellow peril. But instead, I went to Berkeley, stepped foot on that campus as a college student, and was immediately radicalized. Became an Asian American right away. Because of the Asian American movement, created the possibilities of Asian American literature, created a whole lineage of writers that came before me, and then made it possible for my book to emerge and to be read. And so much of my work is about counteracting this idea of being a voice for the voiceless. And when it came time to writing my book of short stories, The Refugees, I wanted to ensure that simply because it was a book that was mostly about Vietnamese people, that it wasn't simply one voice. I didn't want to write a whole bunch of stories about a guy who looked exactly like me. Now, you go to the Vietnamese community, you go into a Vietnamese family of a dozen people, and you're going to get a dozen different voices. And so in the refugees, it was really important for me to know that after I wrote a story about a Vietnamese man, I would write one about a Vietnamese woman. If I wrote a story about someone who was straight, I would write a story about someone who was gay. If I wrote a story about someone who was young, I would write about a story about someone who was old. So the refugees is marked by this attempt to at least gesture at the diversity of a Vietnamese community. And because it was a story, a collection of stories about refugees, it's also marked by haunting. Because growing up in that Vietnamese refugee community of the 70s and 80s, I was aware that all of these refugees were haunted by their past. So I just want to read a couple of pages from the beginning of the book from a story called Black Eyed Women, in which haunting is very much present. Fame would strike someone, usually the kind that healthy-minded people would not wish upon themselves, such as being kidnapped and kept prisoner for years, humiliated in a sex scandal, or surviving something typically fatal. These survivors needed someone to help write their memoirs, and their agents might eventually come across me. "At least your name's not on anything," my mother once said to me. When I mentioned that I would not mind being thanked in the acknowledgments, she said, "Let me tell you a story." It would be the first time I heard this story, but not the last. "In our homeland," she went on, "there was a reporter who said the government tortured the people in prison. So the government does to him exactly what he said they did to others. They send him away, and no one ever sees him again. That's what happens to writers who put their names on things." By the time Victor Devoto chose me, I had resigned myself to being one of those writers whose names did not appear on book covers. His agent had given him a book that I had ghostwritten, its ostensible author the father of a boy who had shot and killed several people at his school. "I identify with the father's guilt," Victor said to me. He was the sole survivor of an airplane crash, 173 others having perished, including his wife and children. What was left of him appeared on all the talk shows, his body there, but not much else. The voice was a soft monotone, and the eyes on the occasions they looked up seemed to hold within them the silhouettes of mournful people. His publisher said that it was urgent that he finish his story while audiences still remembered the tragedy. And this was my preoccupation on the day my dead brother returned to me. My mother woke me while it was still dark outside and said, "Don't be afraid." Through my open door, the light from the hallway stung. Why would I be afraid? When she said my brother's name, I did not think of my brother. He had died long ago. I closed my eyes and said, "I did not know anyone by that name." But she persisted. "He's here to see us," she said, stripping off my covers and tugging at me until I rose, eyes half shut. She was 63, moderately forgetful, and when she led me to the living room and cried out, I was not surprised. "He was right here," she said, kneeling by her floral armchair as she felt the carpet. "It's wet." She crawled to the front door in her cotton pajamas, following the trail. When I touched the carpet, it was damp. For a moment, I twitched in belief, and the silence of the house at 4 a.m. felt ominous. Then I noticed the sound of rainwater in the gutters, and the fear that had gripped my neck relaxed its hold. My mother must have opened the door, gotten drenched, then come back inside. I knelt by her as she crouched next to the door, her hand on the knob, and said, "You're imagining things. I know what I saw." Brushing my hand off her shoulder, she stood up, anger illuminating her dark eyes. "He walked. He talked. He wanted to see you." "Then where is he, Matt? I don't see anyone." "Of course you don't," she sighed, as if I were the one, unable to grasp the obvious. "He's a ghost, isn't he?" So when I was growing up, eventually, and, you know, as a Vietnamese refugee in that Vietnamese refugee community, and knowing that we were haunted by this past, by literal ghosts and figurative ghosts, eventually at some point it occurred to me that we weren't the only ones who were haunted. This country was haunted. But that even more than that, maybe we were the ones doing the haunting of this country. Right? Because when Americans say the word Vietnam, they really mean the Vietnam War. And when they say the Vietnam War, they really mean the American War. That is what the war meant to Americans. And of course, 58,000 plus American soldiers died during that war, and that's a tragedy. But 3 million Vietnamese people died during that war, and 3 million Cambodians and Laotians died during the years of the war and afterwards. And I'm pretty sure most Americans have no idea the war was even fought in Laos and Cambodia, much less have their minds wrapped around this figure of 6 million dead. And when you go to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C., as many of you probably have, you'll see those 58,000 names on that black wall, but you won't see the 6 million names of the Vietnamese and the Cambodians and the Laotians. And the reality is you will never see those 6 million names because those countries don't have the ability to remember all those names, unlike this country. And I had a very small personal experience that reminds me of this idea that American memory is made possible by the forgetting of Southeast Asians, by what happened in my parents' store. So downtown San Jose in the 1970s and 1980s was a very rough place. Despite what that sign said, nope, not too many people wanted to open businesses in downtown San Jose during that time, except for Vietnamese refugees. And at the peak, in the 1990s or so, there were 30 or 40 or more Vietnamese businesses in downtown San Jose. And City Hall really couldn't seem to have cared less for downtown San Jose until something called Silicon Valley happened. And then all this tax revenue started to come into the city, and City Hall thought, well, wouldn't it be great if we had a new City Hall that reflected the new San Jose? Guess where they built it? Not on my parents' store, but directly across the street from my parents' store. And the city forced my parents to sell their property, and they forced all those other Vietnamese business people to sell their properties as well. And my parents learned something new in their long process of Americanization. They learned how to sue. As they should have, because the city was offering pennies on the dollar. But it wasn't really about the money. It wasn't really about the money. After the city took my parents' store, I was so upset. And it wasn't about the money. It was about the fact that this was the place where my parents had shed their sweat and their blood, and that they had sacrificed themselves so much that they couldn't spend time with me or my brother so that they could take care of us and give us the Vietnamese American dream. It was painful to think that this legacy of theirs had been taken away. So for years and years and years afterwards, when I would come back to downtown San Jose, I would always circle around that portion of East Santa Clara Street because I didn't want to see the new City Hall, and I didn't want to see the parking garage that had been built on my parents' property. So that continued for years until something called the Pulitzer Prize happened. And then City Hall thought, wow, wouldn't it be great to invite Viet back to City Hall and give him a commendation? Always be careful about inviting writers to come say something. So I went to City Hall, I took the prize from my classmate, who was actually the mayor of San Jose, and then I told City Hall the same story I'm telling you. But before I went into City Hall, I parked my car beneath City Hall, took the elevator up to street level, and got out of the garage and turned to look across the street to where my parents' store had been, expecting to see that parking garage. And I realized that I had been wrong this entire time. There was no parking garage. It was just a parking lot. And it was only a quarter filled with cars. And it reminded me of a line from The Sympathizer about how America's greatest architectural contribution to the world is the parking lot. And I realized that City Hall preferred to look out onto an empty parking lot rather than to look out onto a Vietnamese mom-and-pop grocery store. And if you go to downtown San Jose today, you don't see my parents' store, you don't see any of those Vietnamese businesses. There will be no signs, there will be no memorials, there will be no plaques to acknowledge that these stores had ever existed. In my mind, we haunt that landscape. In my mind, the forgetting of these Vietnamese people enables this new San Jose to arise. And in my mind, this is one of the reasons why I became a writer. Because if I didn't write these stories, all of this would be forgotten. And as a matter of fact, I wrote one short story that was autobiographical, and it was about my parents' grocery store. And then when The Refugees was translated into Vietnamese this year, the Vietnamese government censored just one short story from the book, and it was the story about my parents' grocery store. So we had been erased in San Jose. We have been erased in Vietnam. And what's left are the stories. So I want to end with one last scene from The Sympathizer. And I realized that maybe I've painted a rather bleak picture of Vietnamese refugee life. But one thing you got to know about people from South Vietnam, we really like to have a good time. So true story, after the Vietnamese refugees left Camp Pendleton, one of the first things they did was to open a nightclub in Los Angeles. This is the setting for this last scene. As the protagonist, the sympathizer, goes to this nightclub and falls in love with the one woman he should not fall in love with, the daughter of his boss, the general. Now known by just one name, like John, Paul, George, Ringo, and Mary, because I'm Catholic, Lana stepped on stage, clad in a red velvet bustier, a leopard print miniskirt, black lace gloves, and thigh-high leather boots with stiletto heels. My heart would have paused at the boots, the heels, or the flat, smooth slice of her belly, naked in between miniskirt and bustier. But the combination of all three arrested my heart altogether and beat it with the vigor of a Los Angeles police squad. They don't laugh about that in LA. It's a little too close to reality. Pouring cognac over my heart freed it, but thus drenched, it was easily flambéed by her torch song. She turned on the heat with her first number, the unexpected I'd Love You to Want Me, which I'd heard before, sung only by men. I'd Love You to Want Me was the theme song of the bachelors and unhappily married males of my generation, whether in the English original or the equally superb French and Vietnamese renditions. What the song expressed so perfectly from lyric to melody was unrequited love. And we men of the South love nothing more than unrequited love. Cracked hearts are primary weakness after cigarettes, coffee, and cognac. Listening to Lana sing, all I wanted was to immolate myself in a night with her to remember forever and ever. Every man in the room shared my emotion as we watched her do no more than sway at the microphone, her voice enough to move the audience, or rather, to still us. Nobody talked, and nobody stirred, except to raise a cigarette or a glass, an utter concentration, not broken, for her next, slightly more upbeat number, Bang Bang, My Baby Shot Me Down. Lana's version of Bang Bang layered English with French and Vietnamese. The last line of the French version echoed Phạm Duy's Vietnamese version, we will never forget. In the pantheon of classic pop songs from Saigon, this tricolor rendition was one of the most memorable, masterfully weaving together love and violence in the enigmatic story of two lovers who, regardless of having known each other since childhood, or because of knowing each other since childhood, shoot each other down. Bang Bang was a sound of memory's pistol firing into our heads, for we could not forget love. We could not forget war. We could not forget lovers. We could not forget enemies. We could not forget home. And we could not forget Saigon. We could not forget the caramel flavor of iced coffee with coarse sugar, the bowls of noodle soup eaten while squatting on the sidewalk, the strumming of a friend's guitar while we swayed on hammocks under coconut trees, the working men who slept in their sea clothes on the streets, kept warm only by the memories of their families, the refugees who slept on every sidewalk of every city, the sweetness and firmness of a mango plucked fresh from its tree, the girls who refused to talk to us and who we only pined for more, the men who had died or disappeared, the streets and homes blown away by bombshells, the shadows cast by candlelight on the walls of wattled huts, the barking of a hungry dog in an abandoned village, the sight and sound of orphans howling by the dead bodies of their mothers and fathers, the stickiness of one's shirt by afternoon, the stickiness of one's lover by the end of lovemaking, the stickiness of our situations. And while the list could go on and on and on, the point was simply this. The most important thing we could never forget was that we could never forget. Thank you, Seattle.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Viet Thanh Nguyen is a professor of English and American Studies and Ethnicity at the University of Southern California. He spoke at this Seattle Arts and Lectures event at Ben Arroyo Hall on May 7th. Thanks to Sonia Harris for our recording. We've presented our broadcast version here. To listen to the full event, which includes his conversation with Jamie Ford, go to kuow.org/speakersforum. Find other great Seattle area talks by subscribing to our podcast. We appreciate your likes and comments. Tune in again soon.